stick on it, check on it, click on it. Help, help.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. Since our program today is a bit longer than normal, I'm going to just jump right in and introduce today's speakers. Actually, it's not a formal talk I'll be playing today, but rather something much more intimate. And that is a recording of a conversation I had a couple of months ago with Myron and Gene Stolaroff. Now, if you go to the program notes for this podcast, you'll find some links to more information about the Stolaroffs. And if you are serious about investigating the history of the use of psychedelic medicines in the Western world today, then you owe it to yourself to learn more about their fascinating lives. It's really impossible for me to sum up the importance of Myron and Gene's contributions to psychedelic research in the limited time I have here for an introduction. But I think it's very safe to say that without the work that they have done, both with the Institute for Advanced Studies in Menlo Park that Myron and others operated, and also with the many weekends of investigative work that they both did in the years after the closing of the Institute, without all of that difficult and very rewarding work, our current understanding of these important substances would not be anywhere nearly as rich and deep as it is today. And if you're looking for two of the true pioneers of modern psychedelic research, well, you won't find two more important people than Gene and Myron Stolaroff. So it's always a special privilege for Mary C. and I to be able to spend a few days with these wonderful friends, particularly when those days are spent with them in their lovely home in the high desert, just at the foot of the majestic Sierra Nevada mountain range. The day that this conversation was recorded was a bright, crystal-clear day. Actually, I believe it was the 10th of November, 2006. Mary C. and I had arrived the day before, and we'd all been engaged in quite a wide-ranging conversation for quite a while before it dawned on me to take out my recorder and capture a little of our conversation for you to listen in on. As you listen, keep in mind the fact that Myron was 86 years old at the time of this recording. I think we can all say that we can only hope that we'll be as sharp as he is when we reach that age. And since I was taught that it is indelicate to mention a lady's age, all I will say about Jean is that she's not the same age as Myron. Let's just say that Myron married a younger woman. Now, the conversation you're about to hear took place around their dining room table just after lunch. And as you'll hear, I'm still trying to figure out a good way to record these interviews, and so there are some places where we pass the microphone back and forth, making enough noise to let you know that there was no professional recording crew at hand. And if you want to get a better idea of what the scene looked like when this recording was made, well, you can check out the photo of Myron that I took at the time. I'll post it with the program notes for this podcast as soon as I get a chance. So let's get started with me kind of fumbling around, trying to figure out how to get Gene and Myron to retell some of their wonderful stories. Maybe we even should start with Gene a little bit, because we were talking last night that there's hardly any women that ever show up on these interviews and stuff like that. And I get a lot of emails from people saying how much they like Ann Shulgin's talks. And you know, I think that if people use these medicines in ways other than just for recreation. And I have nothing against the recreation. I think that, going out and taking one of these medicines and dancing all night is a real good, positive thing. But the kids will come up and say, oh, how do I take this feeling back to work on Monday? And we were talking about that some last night, you know, about how do you maintain these feelings? And I don't think it's easy. I don't think it's automatic. Maybe we just start with how you kind of started using them as a couple, and I don't know where you want to start. How did you first get into this whole area?
When I met Myron through a mutual friend, it was on a blind date, and we sort of kind of, there was a little spark there that started, and we dated briefly, and in 5 months we got married. Well, he told me about his work with the foundation, and I was really impressed. And then he asked me if I wanted to try some LSD, and I said, yes! So he had an airplane at the time and flew over to flew over. This house wasn't here. We stayed in the old shack. And then the next morning, he gave. I put it. Did I take 50 or 100 micrograms of LSD? I don't remember. And we drove. He drove me to Death Valley. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I was going to have an interesting time, but I had no idea it would be so gorgeous. It kept opening. The universe kept opening up. It got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and more beautiful and more beautiful and more beautiful. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I mean, it's just the big picture. I mean, it's much more than just what we see in daily life. It was just, whew, you could see details that you never imagined were there. So it was an exquisite experience, really. And then, I don't remember the sequence of time, but we started working with MDMA when that was being researched.
And that was before it made it into the streets.
But it was still legal, yes. And we called it the love drug because it opened up the heart chakra. And so we did a lot of work with that, and with a lot of different people and couples. You talked about couples earlier. It worked beautifully with couples who were having problems with their relationship with each other, and because they would get to see how foolish they were, to feel left out or hurt or whatever. And so it helped a lot of people. We worked
with
a lot of people.
Was that couples with a therapist or just couples on their own?
Just with us. Mm-hmm. Myron and I would have people. Well, this went on for years. When we built this house, we would have people come here and sit with us. We'd sit with them all day long with MDMA, and it was just wonderful to see how they softened up and recognized how foolish they were to feel the way they did. It was a new world, a new world. And it helped our relationship too, believe me. Because we're pretty different. Anyhow, okay, does that answer your question?
and let me ask.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead, Myra.
Now for the record.
Oh, okay.
I'm just astounded. She's telling you everything with utmost clarity, way beyond anything I think that I can remember. So keep her talking.
I intend to do that, but I want to ask you a quick question about why Death Valley? Why did you go over to Death Valley?
Death Valley was discovered by Al Hubbard. He was in Southern California, and it was Christmas time, and he went up there, and he found it's really a remarkable area. I don't know if you've ever... Have you been to Death Valley?
I've never been there.
Oh, well, it's incredible. You know, part of it is 200 feet below sea level. And the mountains are fabulous, and the colors in the mountains, it's really a remarkable place to go. And when you have the effect of LSD operating, then it's just multiplied intensely. And so it's just a wonderful experience to get over there. So Hubbard and his wife, they had gone over and discovered how nice it was, and he considered right off the bat that this was a really great place to train people. And by this time, you know, we were working in Menlo Park, and we were using LSD legally. And so with Charles Savage as our instructor and leader, and our local psychiatrist, he would be the one who interviewed people to see whether it was appropriate for them to go through the LSD experience. And he had gotten acquainted with Hubbard, and Hubbard with him. In the early days when we just started, he had lived in Canada, but he moved down to Southern California. He was living there for the next few years. And one Christmas time, he and his wife went to Death Valley, and he just found that to be a remarkable place because everything is wide open. First of all, it's totally beautiful. The colors in the mountains are incredible. Rocks, all kinds of things there. It's just an amazing place. And he just felt that that was a wonderful place to take LSD. And so he started sending us there also. I went with him and a friend who was close to us. And actually, let's see if he's on his yeah, Harmon is on the board, Willis Harmon. I went to Death Valley with Hubbard and Harmon, and it was a real interesting experience. I don't open up to these things as well as some of the others, and sometimes it's kind of painful. But between the two of them, they were just having a ball. And finally, toward the end, I began to wake up more, so things progress better. One of the things that's interesting, we were making our way back from Death Valley, coming over here. We're going to spend the night here because it's too far to go back all the way back to the Bay Area. And we were driving back, and it's just really beautiful and incredible. I was still under the influence of LSD, and everything was going really well. So we got to a place, I think we were only about, maybe it's about 15 miles from here. And we'd stopped the car, and there's some old buildings there, and Hubbard always likes to go and explore those kinds of things. So he'd gone out, and so Bill and I were standing there and kind of talking and just wondering, full of wonderment about all the stuff that was going on. And then all of a sudden, we couldn't see him. We thought he'd gone. And our first thought was that, well, now that he's taught us what this is all about, he took off, he's gone away, he's going to leave it all in our hands. But fortunately or unfortunately, he came from behind some building. And so we all got back together again, okay. But that was a remarkable day, and that was a really good experience for me. And
so from there on out, Death Valley was one of your favorite places to...
Yes, that's right. That's exactly right. We didn't... Al used it mostly for training those of us who were helping other people. And in rare cases, and if... we felt they were appropriate people, and especially appropriate, we might take them here. And I've done that a number of times with people.
And that's why you took Jean there. She was especially appropriate.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
Now, if I did my math right, you were probably in your late 30s, early 40s about then? Because you said you had your first experience when you were 36 years old, and so this would have been probably 4 or 5 years after that.
Almost, let's see, it was about 5 years later,
oh, okay.
I guess, that I left Ampex and began to and set up this place in Menlo Park.
But you already had this property here then up in Lone Pine at that time, I guess. You said you were in the other house?
There was a salesman that lived here. He's a wonderful human being, a wonderful person, and Al and he made good friends right away. And also, I made good friends with him. He was a really wonderful person. And he let us come here and be here. We didn't invest in anything as yet, but he was perfectly willing. Because the land wasn't moving very fast around here at that time. So he was willing to let us use the old, there's an old cabin there. And so we would come and use this. And then Al got associated with people in Southern California and some pretty bright people there he would bring up and give them LSD here. And I would join them from time to time. And I got where I really loved this area, and I liked it so much that after a while, I decided to buy it. And at first, I thought that I would share it with Hubbard, and apparently the cost went up some. Originally, I think it was $500 an acre, Then when I wanted to buy it, it was $1,000 an acre. So that was okay with me. And Hubbard says, I'm not going to do that. That's too much money. So that was one of the luckiest things that ever happened to me, as he didn't participate. And I bought the land myself. So I bought 40 acres.
Otherwise, you might have bought it for him, as I understand.
Yes.
Ultimately. Well, maybe we ought to go back to Gene. Your first experience was in Death Valley, and so I guess it was pleasant enough that you decided to have another experience.
And yes, and then Myron and I got married, so there was no question.
No turning back.
No. I knew I'd get a lot of fringe benefits from marrying Myron, and so then he was always willing to try something, and that's why we started using the MDMA, because a dear friend of ours had done some experimenting with that. What he called it, the two martini feeling. So we started taking MDMA along with other compounds, and so it's been continuing, except for lately we haven't done very much, but then it became illegal, and it sort of put the damper on. We couldn't talk about it.
But you found that these were some of these substances better for relationships? Some of them were better for individuals?
We found that MDMA was excellent for couples. And then, of course, I forget the names and titles of the others, but some were good for this and some were good for that, and some were fun, some were not fun.
One I heard mentioned, I guess I read it in one of Myron's books that I've never tried, is 2CE, and I don't know anything about that.
Oh, that's one of the very best.
We loved it because the E for me stood for energy. You got a very nice energy from that. Very lovely stuff, yeah, I remember that.
Did it have the empathy that MDMA did, or was it just...
No, it's more... It's probably more like LSD, but it's a powerful substance, and you learn a great deal from it. I think for quite a while, I thought it was even better than LSD.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's really saying something, because I know you're a fan of LSD.
Yeah.
I don't know where we should go from here.
Well, I might just add a little bit here.
Yeah.
We were very interested in these compounds, and every chance we got, we would try to participate. And there were a lot of new things that came up, and we tried them, and some of them we liked a lot, and there's one or two that are pretty powerful that we didn't care if we never saw them again.
Do you want to mention any of those that you wouldn't care if you ever saw again? I think that's important information.
The aleph? You remember the aleph? They were pretty wild. Uncomfortable.
The aleph? Why don't you...
It's written down somewhere. I can't remember. I'm sorry. I just...
Okay.
That happened. That was a long time ago. But there was a series called Aleph.
Well, there were several things that seemed promising and were powerful. Sometimes it was just too much to handle. And so there are other things that you could sort of grow into more gradually and keep expanding that way. So
you mean too much to handle from a body standpoint or just mental?
Both.
Both, mm-hmm. Yeah. The question I want to ask is, you two have done so much work with together and with other couples, but have you ever, taken MDMA and danced all night? Or have you ever done it like what's called recreationally?
Well,
since you brought that up, I'll say yes. That's one of the things that we like to do. Gene and I would often, after an experience, and it would be different things. Mescaline was very good. Of course, LSD was our favorite. There were other things that we used, and a lot of times toward the end of the day, we'd turn on the music and dance and just had a ball with it.
So you don't have an objection to the recreational end of the medicines, is it?
Oh, not at all. What I'd like to say is we were first introduced to these things while we were living in the Bay Area, and then we decided to move out here, and we did. We had this house constructed, and we moved out here, I think it was in the 1978 is when we finally moved out here. And by this time, we'd had quite a bit of experience with a lot of different substances, and we thought they were valuable, and we thought that maybe we could contribute by exploring with other people and seeing how others responded to it. So for some, I'd say maybe 15, 20 years, we were seeing people very regularly. Sometimes we have people come every weekend. If they got too much and it was getting too much for us, we'd skip a week or two. But we were having people come on a regular basis, and we would use these different substances. It's kind of interesting how people react differently. I think 2CB was one that we thought was pretty good. And then we had some very close friends. They'd been close friends for 20, 30 years. And actually, they had gone through the LSD treatment in Menlo Park when it was legal, and we were providing that function. And they came here. And we used the 2CB, and boy, they didn't like it at all.
Really?
And I was really surprised because we thought it was pretty good. But the thing is, you see, people don't know some of the deep things that carry within our consciousness. These are repressed materials, and they're quite a load to us. And actually, it's of enormous benefit to be willing to go into that, move into it, discover what it is, realize what it is, and be able to release it and be free. And when that happens, that's an extremely freeing experience. It's just like taking a load off of yourself. And so we like to encourage people to do that. But every once in a while, you know, you find people who are up pretty tight and it's almost too much. With those kind of people, what we would do is we'd give them, go through some, and a lot of times they were too resistant and didn't want to go too far. They'd come back another time and have them break through a little more, and hopefully after three or four times they would open up pretty much and get into a lot better space than they were before. So there are a lot of options.
You know, I noticed that in the Shulgin's books, they have recommended dosages for a lot of these. I call them the alphabet soup drugs because I can't keep up with all the names. But it seems to me generally you follow those recommendations; they're about right. But I've noticed that with LSD, people, there's sort of a wide range. I know, like Gary Fisher's work, he was doing really high dose LSD.
Yeah.
And I've heard that somewhere, I think in one of your books, you mentioned Al Hubbard had something he called a high dose session. Do you have any feelings about the high dose LSD versus the low dose LSD? And I'll ask both of you that, actually.
I have a lot. Well, Hubbard knew that I was pretty fragile. And I went to Vancouver and to take LSD there. It was in April. And he had a companion that he liked to have sit with me also. The two of them had worked together quite a bit, and the other man was a younger person, and he'd learned quite a bit with LSD. So my first LSD experience, I was sitting with the two of them. And of course, that first experience was absolutely remarkable, just covered in an awful lot of ground. That original dose is only two-thirds of an ampule. A full ampule would be 100 micrograms. Okay. And so it was a small amount, but I tell you, it was a powerful experience. Are you interested in getting more detail on that?
Yeah, keep going on that.
Okay. On the day I was to have LSD, Hubbard took me to a Monsignor whom he'd formed a great friendship with. And the Monsignor was quite interested in LSD.
Now, you're Jewish, and he took you to a Monsignor. Now, how did you feel about that?
Well, I'll bring that up as time goes on.
Okay.
So I met him, and he blessed me, and he said at noon he would offer a support of some kind that he was willing to support. Well, I'd be right in the middle of it then. And so he was a very wonderful person. Really enjoyed getting acquainted with him. But then we went to Hubbard's home, and that's where I ingested it. When I first took it, after it began to act, I began to realize that, I was really feeling very good and very happy. And then it just occurred to me that all of these monks really didn't understand what it was all about. And I sort of laughed and said, gosh, they don't have any idea what the real reality is about these things. After a while, the thing took a turn, and I began to get really uncomfortable and really hurting. And they asked me to lie down, and I lay down for quite a while, and then I sat up, and
was there music going?
They did have music, and I enjoyed the music. But I was getting more deeply into it, and Hubbard handed me a picture, which is very, very important to him. Well, and for me too. Once I learned about it, but there is a picture of Christ, and you look at it, and you look at his eyes, and they're open. And if you keep looking, they close. So the eyes open and close. And at this point, it was very, very clear, extremely clear. And when I saw the eyes close, I thought, oh, my God, something's wrong with me. He doesn't want to look at me.
That's kind of heavy duty.
It was, believe me. And then, but I kept watching, and then all of a sudden, I began to see other people. And at first, it was just starting to see a few here and there, and then it began to speed up and began to pour out more and more. And I began to see people from all over the world, all kinds of people. I saw pirates, I saw Chinamen. I saw young kids and older people, and just going as fast as you could possibly follow. It just
the parade of life.
The parade. It was exactly that. That's well said. The complete parade of life. And I looked at Christ, and then I realized this is every man.
Mm. Wow, coming from your heritage, that's a pretty profound experience.
That's right.
Was Hubbard a Catholic, or how did he get?
Yeah, he was Catholic.
Okay. So that's how he had the connection with the
Monsignor. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's just on like 66 micrograms of LSD.
Right. Well, at a later stage, I was getting very, very uncomfortable, and really was hurting quite a bit, They had me lie down to see if I could work my way through, and it was really very difficult. So they had me sit up, and they were asking me questions: what about my mother? What about my father? And did they do anything wrong to me? And so on. And it didn't seem to be it. And then all of a sudden, I went into a horrible, horrible, painful thing. And what it seemed to me like is that I was in the womb, and I was trying to get born, And my mother can't stand pain, and they gave her so much ether that she went completely asleep, so the whole action stopped, and I was stuck there and hung there in horrible, horrible pain. And then all of a sudden, I finally broke through, and I shot out, and I screamed. They couldn't wait for me to be born. But that was a great relief coming out of that. Actually, I smelled ether so strongly. It's like they'd taken a wad of cotton with ether and held it over my nose. That's how I experienced it, that real.
Wow.
So after that, things began to get better and easier.
I would hope so, or you'd never do it again.
So it kept getting better and better. And then I know that there was, at one time, I felt very guilty that I'd been doing things wrong and I was being punished somehow. And then all of a sudden that broke out, and all of that wasn't necessary at all. I was able to rise above that and feel great. So that's pretty much
the
story.
How long did that session last, do you think?
At least six to 8 hours.
So, and then after it was over, you guys just kind of talked and...
We kind of hung around for a while, yeah. And dear old his wife, Rita, she is a remarkable person. We got to be the very best of friends. And of course, she had a nice dinner prepared for us and everything. And so all went well.
It wasn't so painful that you didn't ever want to do it again. You.
The benefits were so great. I discovered all kinds of things. No, it was a complete win as far as I was concerned. There were these difficult areas, but that's the stuff that was in me, and just you have to find a way to resolve it. But you have to be willing to resolve it. And we've had a lot of experience later, you know, where people just weren't willing to get into those places. And okay, let's let them go and try it again another time. And each time, people face it more completely until finally they break through. And once you get that breakthrough, then you realize that there's an enormous accomplishment that's enormously worthwhile.
But do you have anything you want to add right here?
Well, this might be a little bit on the negative side because Myron's birth experience has always come up in most of his LSD experiences. And even in some of the others, he would always get back in. It's kind of the doldrums, I call it. And this, although you haven't done it for many years, I don't think, but it always used to come up, and he would be in the doldrums for a while, usually at the beginning of an experience. But then by the end of the day, he'd come out of it, and we'd laugh and sing and put on high dance music or high energy dance music or whatever. And this was both with just the two of us and with the group. Mm-hmm. So Myron's birth experience. Myron's birth experience was really, I think, I don't know whether you've ever gotten over it completely. It's heavy duty.
But before I ask Myron this question, let me ask you: what was your second experience? Was it also LSD, or how did you progress? Into
oh my gosh. Oh, let me think. I'm having a hard time remembering. Because we used to have groups, and mostly with groups.
I think it wasn't too long a time after you had LSD that we got MDMA. And, you know, that was a whole new turn of things. And we did that with really supreme company. And it was just really, it's just a really remarkable thing. It's just very, very pleasant. We got into that a fair amount.
Did you put LSD aside for a while there when you got into MDMA and some of the new?
We used different things. You know, we had a choice of quite a number of products. We were very fortunate to have some of those things. So.
because we talked about this last night, and I told you how my first experience, I was fearful for months. It took a lot of time to get courage. Were you fearful for before your first LSD experience? How did you address that going into it, or were you just anxious to do it?
Oh, I was anxious to do it because I didn't anticipate any pain or difficulties. Maybe I should add this a little bit. I'd gotten very well acquainted with Gerald Hurd. He's a brilliant, brilliant man. And he had taken LSD with Hubbard, and also accompanied by Aldous Huxley. And I had liked him a lot. Every time I went to Southern California, I'd always go to see him, and it was great seeing him. He always welcomed me. And then one day he told me that he and Huxley had taken LSD with Hubbard. And I thought, my God, here's one of the most brilliant men on the planet and one of the highest level thinkers. And why in the world would he want to take something like that? And so he told me it was very worthwhile. And so that's when I wrote a letter to Hubbard. And
What did you say in your letter to Hubbard? You just wrote to him out of the blue, right?
Well, the sequence was this. So after I got the information from Gerald Hurd, well, I hadn't really done anything particularly, but much to my amazement, our president of our company had gone to Canada, and he heard about Hubbard and people taking LSD, and he really got pretty excited about it. And when he came back, he told me about that, and so I decided then to contact Hubbard, and I wrote him a letter. And I think it was only a month or two that he came to Ampex and looked me up.
He just showed up?
He just showed up with his wife and a good personal friend, a very nice lady that they were good friends with. And so we went to... they were in a motel, and I went and joined them there, and then he laid me down and gave me a few whiffs of Carbogen, and he was very careful not to give me too much. He's a smart guy, so I think I only had about four breaths. Usually we give people 15 or 25 or something. That really, that loads you. And incidentally, that's an area that we haven't discussed at all yet. So we'll get back to that. So it was a short thing and felt really good, and I saw very nice pictures, and so made a really close connection with him. And the result was he invited me to come up April. I think when we first saw him, I think it was still the fall before, but then I went up the following April, and I've already told you what happened there.
You know, we're circling back to what kind of started this thing is I asked you the difference between a high dose and a low dose crowd, where you fall. You Menlo Park was more of I call it Menlo Park, the Institute for Advanced Studies. Excuse me, was sort of a low dose, 100 microgram or so that you were giving people?
Oh, no, we gave them more than that.
Oh, did you?
Don't forget, we had... Charlie Savage was our medical director, and he was very skilled and very understanding. The people who were going through our program, they always went to him first, and he would talk to them, and he's very good at assessing people. And so he would make the determination whether he thought it was appropriate for them to go through our program or not. And most of the time, I think it's very rare that he ever rejected anyone.
Yeah, I find that kind of fascinating because today, kids just go out, and teenagers and middle school even, and take acid for the first time with some friends out, sneaking around. Well, you really had a program where you... you took people through Carbogen, and then you talked to them, you interviewed them before their first session. This was
absolutely. Oh, we spent generally we spent several weeks with them. They come in just once a week, and we would see them maybe three or four times to get better acquainted. We'd give them Hubbard was the one that brought this to our attention, Carbogen, and they would come and we would discuss things with them, find out what their problems were, what they were looking for, and so on. And then we'd give them the Carbogen. Do you understand what Carbogen is?
70% oxygen, 30% CO2, right?
Right. Okay. Yeah, and they would breathe that, and you get a lot of action out of that. But Hubbard loved, he'd love calling people around, and while he gave me Carbogen, because usually I exploded all over the place, and I would just fuck him, or Jesus Christ, or something. I'd always come up with something. They all got a big kick out of it.
So you were the demonstrator.
The demonstrator, yeah.
Yeah, you're the demonstrator. And if they saw your demonstration and still felt they wanted to try it, then they passed the test.
Right on.
Did you subject Gene to any of these tests?
I don't think you ever took Carbogen, did you?
I'm afraid to say I didn't care for it. I took maybe five breaths and I didn't like it. I resisted, I guess. I guess I'd be too frightened. Mm-hmm. So it's scary.
What was it like for you?
Nothing happened. Nothing happened. I was just really scared. You know, because you put the over your nose. I felt almost smothered. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't open for that one.
But how about before your first LSD experience? Were you frightened at all about that?
Oh, no, I was very excited. I heard Myron's stories about the foundation and about how people got a lot out of these experiences. And I thought, well, it sounds good to me. And I was such a square before that. I wouldn't even think of taking a toke of marijuana, for heaven's sakes. But, no, I wasn't. I don't think I... Well, a little bit. A little bit scared, but, you know...
Not too intimidated.
No, I thought it was wonderful.
Now, your first experience was, what, around 100 micrograms? Is that
it was either 50 or 100, I don't remember.
I think it was 100, because by then we were...
An ampule, an ampule from Switzerland.
So I assume that you did it a few more times after that, though, before the MDMA showed
up. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Yes, we did. Uh-huh.
Always in Death Valley, or did you...
Oh, no, a lot in Menlo Park. We lived in Menlo Park. No, we used to...
Then we moved here, and we would partake at times when we thought it was appropriate for us.
So here's a question for Gene, that... because I was a square before my first time, too, mm-hmm. and... a lot of my friends pretty much just thought I had lost it all after. Did you have any reaction from your friends, or did you even tell them yours?
I did not advertise. But we did. We were able to have our children involved in the MDMA business, and they knew what we were doing. But no, I couldn't talk about it with anyone. It wasn't something you would talk to someone about unless you knew them intimately.
Yeah.
Because it's very profound, what the stuff that comes up and the stuff that you realize you have to handle and how you're running your life.
Did any of your former friends ever gravitate to the psychedelic lifestyle at all? Your personal friends that you had before you met Myron?
No. So I don't believe so. We had a group around the Menlo Park area, and we were, maybe there were six or eight of us. Mm-hmm. And we knew each other, and we stayed in that group mostly. But so we didn't have any other friends.
How about you, Myron? Did other people at Ampex get involved in LSD? Or was it just you, or did the president really get involved in it?
The president... met Al Hubbard and agreed to have an experience with him. But on the day that he was to do it, he changed his mind. So he never did. And he ended up never taking it.
Did you have any people at Menlo Park that went through the preparation and got close and then backed out that when they got there?
Well, we had 350 people go through over 3.5 years. And I'd say by a large majority that most of them felt that they had been benefited quite a bit. I had a lot of friends in AMPAX where I worked, and a number of them were interested in what I was doing, and several of them came and participated. And almost all of them felt that they had been quite benefited. They learned how to get along better with their wives and their kids and stuff like that. And it wasn't a big number, but it was quite satisfying to us to know that we had some of these people who thought enough of what we were doing that they would come and participate.
Were you doing meditation before you started doing LSD, or when did meditation come into your life?
There was a group in Palo Alto that were very deeply into spirituality. Harry Rathman was an attorney, and he taught that at
Stanford.
At Stanford University, and he was very, very popular, a very lovable person. And at the end of each year, he would have a real large room, and people could come and get some really good experience about the possibilities of life and so on. And it got to be a favor that the school got really used to, so that every year people would flood in to just hear him at their last program. Anyway, he and his wife were really, really very good at introducing people to spirituality. And I joined them, and I was part of that group for a long time, and found it very helpful. That's where I learned a lot about meditation and did a lot of personal practice with meditation. And so that was a really good association. And when Hubbard came along, I introduced them to them, and nobody liked him. And some of them wanted to take off and work with LSD on their own, and they didn't know shit. So I was very disappointed. They wanted to go hear Hubbard knew all of this stuff backwards and forwards and everything, but they wanted to go ahead and do it their own way, and I couldn't take that. I said goodbye to him.
Was that part of the Sequoia seminar group that split out?
My remembering of your story about the Sequoia seminar was that you were totally enthralled with it, and you were taught the teachings of Jesus, mm-hmm. and you were in a state of shock when they told you that you have to read this book about the true teachings of Jesus. And I thought you were enthralled with it. I didn't realize that you broke off with that group.
Yeah. I was involved with this group for quite a number of years. Mm-hmm. Now, the first part, as what you're talking about, Well, I'll tell you this. It may not be much interest, but at least you'll have it if you want it. I had a neighbor who lived very close to me, and we both worked together at AMPAX. And he had heard a little bit about Rathman. And Rathman was giving a series of talks, and he said, "Man, why don't you come with me?" So I said, "Okay." And so I listened to him, and Rathman was a marvelous teacher and a marvelous instructor, and I really liked everything he said. And I think we went for several weeks in a row. And then toward the end, it turned out that I'm really a little dim on, I knew it was really important what he was saying, and I thought, and I was really glad I was going. But then all of a sudden he threw in this thing about spirituality and Christ, and I immediately felt I'd been screwed.
So bait and switch.
But a few months went by, and they began starting having local gatherings. So I thought, oh, what the hell, I'll go. And so I went, and Rathman was leading the group. And I sort of got pulled in and began to enjoy it more. And an awful lot of wisdom came from a person who's a name that I don't remember. The Rathmans were very, very close to him. And they felt this particular man had spent 30 years of his life to find the real truth about Christ and what was really important and what was sort of made up by people. And so that what you finally got out of it was very, very sound information. And I really enjoyed that. So in spite of being Jewish, I belonged to that group and I stayed with them for a long time. And I became actually part of the leadership group.
Charmin.
So that went on for quite a while.
Charmin?
Charmin was the one that did set all that up. Good for you, too. Good memory.
Book. Yeah.
Then when Hubbard came into the picture, none of those people, well, I think I already said this, none of those people really cared for him.
Was he like boisterous, or what was it that...
Yeah, they felt he was too cocky, and I'm not sure what the problem was, because I was having a great time with him. But I think I already covered that some of the people decided they would try to work with LSD. And I felt they didn't know what they were doing or how to do it, and they didn't want to follow Hubbard. And Hubbard's the one that really knew all about it.
Right.
So I departed from that group. And we did have a group. There were two or three people there, but I began meeting once a week. We had people come together. And then we reached the point where one person who volunteered would take LSD, and this was mostly done at our home, and it was done in the evening, and they would take it and the rest of us would just be there as supportive.
And one person would take it and the rest would support?
Yeah. And then a week later we would review it all, what the person got, what they felt was important about it. And then another person would be chosen, and then they would go through it. And finally, I think we had only about eight people in the group. We finally went through where all eight people went.
Yeah, I guess I have to ask this question, because I've been in circles where a group has supported somebody that's been smoking DMT, but it's like 15 minutes, and that seems like forever. It's boring waiting for the person. How did you all sit there and support somebody for an LSD trip, which is hours? I mean, did you just sit there in silence? Or
yeah.
You, really?
Yeah. We meditated. Then, after a while, maybe 2-3 hours went by. If there wouldn't be any discussion, we could bring up discussion with the group. But we didn't. We didn't fall into that too much. We usually let the person just go through, and then we talk about it the week later when we got together again.
Now, did you keep your meditation practice up through this whole time, or did it slip when you first started doing LSD? And...
Oh, no, I think I got pretty wedded to meditation with this group, actually. And so I meditated regularly.
Which you still do every day?
Yeah.
So my guess is that you would recommend that meditation practice should be, or is beneficial.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, if you're going to work with these materials, meditation is a marvelous supporter because as you use the materials, you open your consciousness more, and that opens your meditation more. So then your meditation becomes more effective and more fulfilling. So it's a growing process.
I asked you last night, and I loved the answer, you know, what would your life have been like without LSD?
Oh, God. It would have been miserable by comparison. Absolutely miserable. Oh, no, taking LSD was just a remarkable change of life. Yeah. And it's just criminal that our nation holds it down so thoroughly. They won't have anything to do with it. They don't even want to look at it. That's changing a little bit now. It's changing a little bit. And there may be some LSD work that will be permitted. But it's just a shame that it's so valuable and so effective that and here we are supposed to, the nation is supposed to be the most open, and it's become one of the most rigorous enemies.
Amazing.
Yeah.
You know, Gene, one of the things that kind of bugs me is that we hear all these men talking about these experiences, and how you know, is LSD only a male thing, or how has it affected your life?
Well, I don't know. They just interview the men. They don't interview the ladies. But anyway, I don't know whether... No, it's not a male thing. I know a lot of women that have taken LSD and liked it. And I was just wanted to comment about the first experience that I had, I remember. But, you know, I don't remember the ones after that. And so much was going on. But the first time I took it, it's mind-opening. And even if you only take it once, you really learn a great deal. So you don't have to take it every week or every month or every year. That's your choice.
Well, you know, I've found with some of these other the other medicines that many times the first experience is such a peak experience that it's difficult to really repeat that one. Have you found the same thing?
Yeah. Oh, they're never the same. I've never had two experiences that were the same. But I don't remember clearly like I do the first one. I remember the first one very clearly, but I don't remember the others.
There seems to be a kind of dynamic that takes place, and it's almost like your first experience is a real opener. It's almost like there's something there that wants to sort of pull you in and let you know that there is way more to life than you ever thought before. So you kind of get a nice start. But then, if you're going to continue taking it, you're going to have to begin to open the doors that we've locked up and that we haven't wanted to see at all. But sooner or later, you've got to open those things up. And so that for a while, it looks like it's turning against you, but it's not turning against you. It really wants to help you get into these deeper areas and release them and understand them, because they're powerful things, and we're all carrying that stuff around, and it's like dragging rocks, piles of rocks that we have to pull around. That's what it's like, and you can get free of all that stuff. So,
I guess the thing is, and maybe Huxley started saying this, that, you know, it opens the doors, but you've got to go through and do the work if you want to.
Absolutely.
The enthusiasm of the profound experience, it fades away. You know, how do you maintain that, I guess, through the hard work?
What happens a lot, and I talk to this every chance I get when we go to Kathleen's place. And these people are taking it, and they're not really committing themselves to honor what they learned and do their best to make use of it. And every chance I get, when I get to a group or any of these people, I always try to bring this up because I see it so much. It's just, you go to a certain point and it's like, well, this has been great and we learned a lot, but they don't realize that there's way, way more waiting for you. And the only way that you can keep developing and learning more and getting into higher levels of consciousness is by really exerting yourself and learning to use everything that shows up when you do have these experiences. So it's kind of disappointing when you go to Kathleen's and you see how many people, you know, they love having the experience and they love repeating it. But I would say it's only maybe a third of them, and maybe I'm being too harsh here, maybe half of them, but it seems to me somewhere between a third and a half of them aren't really exerting themselves to put into effect what they could learn.
Yeah, and you know, that may be pretty much true across the board, I'm afraid. That, that we've been kind of a society, I think, you know, brought up on the instant fix and you can quick do this, quick weight loss diets and all these things and take a pill and you're going to feel good. But, you know, it's not like you can keep taking these pills and have them work for you.
So. Yeah.
Maybe we ought to take a little break.
That's a good idea.
And
I guess one of the main things I hope you get from this conversation today is to have some idea of the intense amount of preparation that took place before people had their first LSD experience back in the early days of its use. In my humble opinion, we should still be using some of those techniques, at least in some modified form. And in the future, I hope to podcast several more reminiscences about Al Hubbard, who is often called the Johnny Appleseed of LSD. And no matter what one thinks about this exceptional man, I think it's safe to say that he was indeed one of the major forces in spreading the word about LSD. You know, the people he turned on for the first time largely make up a who's who of the early LSD researchers, you know, names like Gerald Hurd, Humphrey Osmond, Aldous Huxley, and Myron Stolaroff, among others, immediately come to mind when Hubbard's influence is discussed. But just yesterday, Gary Fisher told me something about Al Hubbard that I hadn't picked up on before. You know, while Myron and I discussed the fact that Hubbard was a Catholic, it was Gary who explained to me just how Catholic he was. Apparently, in the early days of LSD research here in North America, religious iconography was almost universally used, and it appears to have its genesis in use in the embodiment of one Al Hubbard. In particular, the painting called St. Veronica's Veil appears to be as much a part of the experience in the early days as the music of Pink Floyd is for me today. The irony, of course, is that Al Hubbard was also somewhat of a con man. Perhaps that's a little harsh, but after hearing so many stories about him, it's hard to avoid the conclusion that if you were a close friend of Al's, it wouldn't be long before some significant sums of your hard-earned cash would wind up being used for one of Al's various, what shall I call them? Maybe I'll just say one of Al's pet projects. I'll have more to say about all this next week when I play another recording I made of a conversation Myron and I had later that same day. And by the way, I'm not going to get next week's podcast out until Thursday, so don't worry when it doesn't appear on the now usual Wednesday evening. But before I go today, I want to point out one more thing, and that is the experience of seeing the parade of life that Myron had during his first LSD experience. The reason I mention it is that just recently another friend of mine said that she had had the exact same experience during one of her first ayahuasca experiences. And it seems to be a common theme for a lot of us, so at least in our early explorations. And I have no idea what all that means, but since it does seem to be a common experience, it may be something you want to think about on your own sometime. You know, just what is this vast parade of human life all about anyway? As the King of Siam once has said, it's a puzzlement. Well, once again, I'm going to have to sign off without mentioning any of the email I've been receiving. One reason is that after returning home from a weekend retreat, I discovered that the notes from the Psychedelic Salon blog, the place where I post the program notes for these podcasts, well, that blog just totally crashed. So I spent several days trying to fix it until, in desperation, I turned to the excellent tech support team at DreamHost for help, and within a few hours, they had the site up and running for me again. So, hey, thanks again, all you tech support guys at DreamHost. And if any of the rest of you went to our blog and couldn't get in, well, give it a try again, and hopefully it'll be running along glitch-free. You know, at least until Mercury goes retrograde again, huh? By the way, you can get to that part of our website in a number of different ways, but the direct link is simply www.psychedelicsalon.org. Before I go, I should mention that this and all of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are protected under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike 2.5 license. And if you have any questions about that, just click the link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage, which you can find at matrixmasters.com/podcasts. If you still have questions, just send them to lorenzo@matrixmasters.com. I want to thank my friends at Chateau Hayuk for the use of their music here in the salon, and I guess I've been somewhat remiss in not doing a better job of letting you know the source of the background music here in the salon. Chateau Hayuk is the name of a group whose music you're hearing, and in particular, the cut that I play is from their self-titled album and is titled El Alien. And there's a link to their MySpace site from our main podcast page, and you can also go directly to it, www.myspace.com/Chateau Hayuk, and that's spelled C-A-T-A-L-H-U-Y-U-K. Well, that's it for today. Thanks again for being here. It really does mean a lot to me. And until next week, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.